collection does.
I think generally if you're engaged in the business of literature, you are engaged in an act of trying to expand the spectrum of who gets to be called human. Because I think we've set up the kind of societies that implicitly or explicitly rely on huge swaths of the population being considered subhuman and not worthy of basic dignity. And I think if you're writing, if you're engaged in literature, you are trying to obliterate that classification. And I don't consider it to be an obligation of any writer to change anyone's mind. If you write fiction, that in of itself is enough. All I'm trying to do is for the duration of however long it takes for the reader to go through my book, is to get them to not look away.
That's Omar El-Akkad. Later in the show, we talk with him about his novel, What Strange Paradise. It's about what happens when a Syrian refugee, a young boy, washes up on a Greek island. But first, Mohsin Hamid tells us about his fable of race and humanity. It's called The Last White Man. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What would it be like if white people lost their whiteness? Not just the privilege that comes with whiteness, but the skin color itself. How would they deal with a world where, all of a sudden, they woke up brown? That's the device at the heart of Mohsin Hamid's novel, The Last White Man. It's a kind of fable that examines what happens when the social construction of race falls away to reveal our fundamental humanity. Mohsin Hamid is the author of 5 novels, including Exit West and The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Mohsin Hamid, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, The Last White Man, is a kind of fable about the social construction of race. What inspired you to write this book?
I think a couple of different things. One is that I'd lived in many different countries. I spent part of my childhood in the U.S. and then went back to Pakistan, then back to the U.S., Britain, Pakistan again. And so I'm a very, I guess, hybridized, mongrelized person. And all over the world today, we see this return to a kind of tribal identity, where dominant groups in each country seem to be increasingly attracted to defending the pure, original people, the folk. And that's something which I find very threatening because as a mongrelized, hybridized person who's not purely anything, there's not that much place for me in a world where every country is the pure nation of its pure people. And the other part of my way in was after 9/11, something quite strange happened for me. You know, I had been to these elite universities, I had a well-paying job in New York City, a very cosmopolitan city, and by and large, I had passed without too much difficulty. And then I found myself suddenly being stopped in airports for extra searching. I would be held at immigration for several hours when I arrived in the country. People seemed uncomfortable if I arrived on a bus with a bit of a beard and a backpack. I became an object of suspicion and possibly of threat. And I felt like I wanted things to go back to the way they were. I felt that I'd lost something. And as I thought about this over the years, I began to realize that what I'd lost in a way was a kind of partial whiteness, a kind of sense of belonging, of being allowed to pass. And I thought, you know, why do I want this thing back? You know, what had I been complicit in? You know, was this thing a good thing that I wanted? And those thoughts, I guess, over the years and decades, led their way to this novel, The Last White Man.
And it's a profound experience of the loss of whiteness that happens to the protagonist, a man named Anders. First, I just wanted to ask you about his name. Anders means other in German. Was that a deliberate allusion?
Yeah, well, Anders is an interesting name because it's a root of other or stranger. It's a root of manly or man, and it occurs in many European languages. And so I liked it in that it was, you know, this idea of this man or this strange man, and also because it feels like it comes from a kind of imaginary place. that has sort of connotations of whiteness, like it comes from some primeval white place, that Anders and Una, whoever they are, their names seem to come from an interesting space. And much the way in my novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, I tried to use the character's voice to create a sort of impression of a particular type of Islam. I wanted to use Anders and Una's names as a way of creating an impression of a particular kind of whiteness.
We'll get to Una, who is Anders' girlfriend, but he wakes up one morning to find that his skin has turned dark. And you don't use the word black in the book, and there's no reference to anything other than a skin change. Are you leaving the non-white nature of this change deliberately vague, and if so, why?
Well, I guess there's two aspects to that. The novel explores the idea that that this sort of whiteness is kind of imagined. You know, it's a fictional thing. That race is something that we invent. It's not something that is, in a sense, determined. It's not like a planet or a waterfall. It's not something that just exists. It's something that we imagine into being. And so it wasn't that I wanted Anders to be moved from whiteness to a different race. I wanted him to experience simply not being white. But also, I wanted him, or the reader really, to be free to imagine this experience for themselves. I think one of the things that novels do, which makes novels quite special and different from films and television, is that in films and television, you see a world that is imagined for you to a large extent. It looks like the world. But a book doesn't look anything like the characters or the places or the feelings or the images or sensations that it represents. Those things are created by readers in their imagination from the words. And so I try to write books that allow readers to imagine their way in, that allow readers to imagine what is happening. And so by being intentionally vague on what Anders looks like, the reader is free, in a sense, to create the Anders of their imagination after his change. And for some readers, that character might look like what some people might call black. For others, might look like somebody who perhaps looks like me. But that's really an option left to the reader and the reader's imagination.
And it really works. I mean, I was trying to imagine what it would be like to wake up with my skin having turned a different color. And I think it really also increases the intimacy and the emotional power of the book. And now his first reaction, Anders's first reaction, is that he's been the victim of a crime. He's been robbed. And you've already alluded to, you know, being robbed of one's partial whiteness. But a crime and a victim means that there's been a perpetrator. Who is the perpetrator here, according to Anders?
You see, Anders struggles to figure out who this perpetrator is. You know, he is seen differently. And of course, society, in a sense, is a kind of perpetrator because society is seeing him differently. But he also feels guilty. He feels, you know, maybe something is wrong with me. He doesn't want to show himself. He's afraid. He's uncertain. You know, is he, Anders, in some way the perpetrator of his own fate? Is it the universe? Is it how people perceive him? Is it society? And I think one of the pernicious things about race is it's so hard to figure out who the perpetrator is. You know, of course, if one is looked at as being from a dangerous or threatening race, one can immediately say that's ridiculous. And this is entirely a problem in the person viewing me. But it's very hard to escape the feeling that perhaps I am somehow to blame. Maybe there is something wrong with me. Maybe I am somehow bad. And so Anders is in a very difficult situation, in the same way really that anybody who's forced into being viewed from a racial lens is in a difficult situation. It's really hard to figure out who the perpetrator is, and hard to prevent yourself from blaming yourself.
And did you feel that when your status, your racial status changed after 9/11?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite confusing in the sense that did one need to act in a very secular way? You know, should one be more overt in one's condemnation of terrorism? You know, do you need to, make sure that you're walking with your girlfriend who's dressed in a short skirt and that you're seen in a bar, you know, holding up a glass of alcohol? Like, what do you have to do to not be seen in this way? And, are there steps that one could take? Are there steps that one should take And so I think, you know, this is something which is quite pernicious, the ways in which, you know, one feels that one has to respond to a kind of racial perception, not because you have changed and not because you are a threat, but because since you're seen differently, since you're seen as threatening, it's almost as though you have to do something to counteract that. And so, yes, that's what Andrews is grappling with.
Mm. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mohsen Hamid about his new book, The Last White Man. So tell us about Una, Andrews's girlfriend. She is the only one he tells at first. How does his changing change their relationship?
Una is, like Anders, somebody who's experienced loss. Her father died when she was young. Her brother has died more recently. Anders' mother died when he was a young man. And in a sense, they're both drawn together in a way as people who've experienced loss. They had a relationship in high school. But when the novel begins, it's more like they're having a kind of fling. They're just sort of passing the time. But something strange begins to happen to them as Anders changes and as Una changes. It's as though they become able to see each other more clearly. That as Anders changes, what Una begins to see in Anders is what is still Anders. In other words, his surface may have changed, but there's something in this guy that she recognizes more clearly now that he looks different. Weirdly enough, paradoxically enough, the fact that Anders and Una change allows them to understand each other better.
And it deepens their relationship. I mean, I found that this was a love story as well as a fable about the social construction of race.
It is very much a love story. And in a way, it's a love story and it's a eulogy. It's a story about love in different dimensions. So there's Anders and Una and their relationship and how it has to evolve and how they, in a sense, come together to deal with loss and then stay together to deal with an entirely different kind of loss, the loss of race, which they hadn't expected to deal with. But it's also about Anders' love for his father and Una's love for her mother, people from a different generation who are grappling with the situation in very different ways. And as the older generation passes on and grapples with this situation, Anders and Una, in a sense, accompany them, that they're witnessing an older generation that's clinging to different views. In Anders' father's case, reaching the end of their lives. And in Una's mother's case, really struggling to accept what's happening. So it's a story not just of the love between two people, but also of a kind of love between two generations, you know, generations that don't see eye to eye, but are still linked in this profound way.
Yes. And also the reaction, not just of the older generation, but of other people around them, at least early on. The change begins to happen everywhere. It's not just Una and Anders. But the reaction at first is violent. So talk about that initial reaction and then how it changes.
So what happens at first is that Anders doesn't know anybody else who's changed. He's the only person. He feels, you know, in a sense, terrible. He's scared to show himself. He's scared to reveal what's happened to him. And then he tries to still be himself. He goes to work and tries to act like himself. And he discovers that trying to act like himself is, in fact, there's nothing more unlike yourself than trying to be yourself. You know, he's trying to be natural, which makes him unnatural. And then as more people change, society begins to react. And in a sense, there's an overreaction. You see these militias forming. You see a degree of violence happening. And I think that that, in some senses, is like what we've seen with COVID-19. That when COVID-19 first appeared, and before we had our vaccines and our treatments, what seemed to happen to people was, in some cases, they would get this disease. Their immune system wouldn't recognize it at first. And then it would overreact and go so wild in its overreaction that it would damage, you know, our own lungs and organs and bring about catastrophic illness and in some cases death, the overreaction of the immune system to a sudden threat that it hadn't perceived before. Something quite similar happens in Anders and Una's town, that at first not much seems to happen except for the individuals. And then suddenly there's a kind of societal panic and a degree of violence. And then, of course, that passes and something else comes into existence.
So the title of the book is The Last White Man, which actually refers to Anders's father. And everybody else changes. I found this so uplifting, so encouraging, so hopeful. It's like my soul cried out for a world where everybody was the same, but everybody isn't the same. I've heard you talk about how the end of race allows other difference to come about. Talk about that.
Well, you see, in a sense, there's a kind of liberation in this. You know, we imagine that whenever there's a dominant group in any society, you know, whether that be a particular kind of Muslim in Pakistan or Hindu in India or, you know, Britishness in Britain or Russianness in Russia or whiteness in America, that there can only be something lost for that group if the group were to be less dominant or less perceived as being a cohesive, special thing. But that isn't actually only the case. There's also an enormous opportunity and release and relief in being freed of the burdens of being a group that has to dominate other groups. And so in The Last White Man, what begins to happen is, of course, there's a sense of loss, a profound sense of loss. And the book tries to explore that from the inside of characters who really feel that this is a tragedy. But there's also something being born, people able to experience different aspects of who they are and have those things come to the fore, which, of course, doesn't mean that everybody's now the same. You know, perhaps your economic status or other aspects of who you are become more significant. It's not that everybody suddenly is the same, but it is that people are free to explore who they are in a much more flexible way than they were before. And partly, I think, in societies, what happens is these things happen across generations. It's not that we become perhaps more open-minded over time. It's that we hold on to our views over time, and new generations are born and grow up, and they are more open-minded than we were. What the novel does is it sort of plays with that and compresses this phenomenon that happens over the decades and generations and centuries and makes it happen in just a few years and allows us to experience that in the lives of characters in just a short story.
And both in this book and in your previous, is Exit West the last book before this one?
Yes, that's right.
You use a twist on reality. I don't know if I would call it magical realism because it's just kind of one twist on reality. But talk about how you play with reality in your fiction, how that drives your, I don't want to say message, that's a little too heavy-handed, but drives a narrative.
I think that what's very interesting is we spend so much of our lives dealing with what we think is reality. But at a deeper level, reality may not entirely exist. So, for example, we see colors like blue and red and yellow. But actually, those colors are the ways in which our brain represents different reflected wavelengths of light. Those colors are a representation that we make. And similarly, we think that, you know, I'm a nice guy or I'm a nice woman and I behave in a respectful way. And then sometimes we lash out and we do things that are really quite nasty. And we tell ourselves, you know, I wasn't myself, but we were ourselves. It's just that the fiction that we tell ourselves about always being nice and always being considerate is partly a fiction. We've made up this view of ourselves that's nicer perhaps than who we actually are. And so what fiction allows us to do is to take off the burden of pretending that reality is real and allowing it to become a little bit more slippery, allowing us to play with stuff, allowing us to inhabit a space that that is, in a sense, invented by us and feels true because we recognize that we're inventing stuff all the time. So in my novels, what I often do is I take reality and skew it just very slightly. Everything is recognizable, but one or two elements maybe are just slightly off. And what I think that allows the reader to do is to enter into a kind of experience, like when you play make-believe as a child and you agree to be pirates or firemen or astronauts, and you allow yourself to enter into this imagined space that's very fertile for the reader. So yeah, what I try to do is really that, is to I guess, more than impart a message, to invite the reader to engage in playing together a kind of game of make-believe, and afterwards to reflect upon how that made them feel.
And it works. I can attest to that. And there's a passage in the book. Do you happen to have the book with you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, that's great. So there's a passage in the book that I think does really reflect that from Una's point of view. It's on page 68, and it's the second paragraph going into 69 on the top. It's just one paragraph. I wonder if you could read it. It starts out with, "Una, too, felt something different."
Una, too, felt something different, not just in Anders, for she saw there was something different in him, but in herself, in the way she was drawn to him, not as a silencing of what she did not want to hear, not only that, not anymore, but as an opportunity to speak, as a beginning rather than the managing of an end. And maybe the fact that Anders no longer looked like Anders allowed her to see her relationship with him in another way. Or maybe the fact that Anders remained Anders, regardless of what he looked like, allowed her to see the Anders in him more clearly. But whatever it was, she was glad to be there with him, glad and human. Her need not mechanical, not a mechanism, but organic, and so more complicated, and also more fertile.
It's a beautiful book, The Last White Man. Mohsen Hamid, thank you so much for talking with us here about this book. And I would very much look forward to talking with you about a next book if one is coming.
Thank you, Francesca. I'll look forward to that too.
Mohsen Hamid. Read an excerpt from The Last White Man at writersvoice.net. Next up, Omar El-Akkad and What Strange Paradise. Stay tuned after the break. That was Everyday People by Sly and the Family Stone. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The world was shocked when 2-year-old Alan Kurdi's body washed up on a Turkish beach in 2015 after he and his family fled from Syria. Then the world seemed to forget. But the drownings continue. More than 3,200 people died or went missing, crossing the Mediterranean for Europe just in 2021. Omar El-Akkad's new novel, What Strange Paradise, tells the story of a Syrian child migrant who's washed up on a Greek island. The novel follows him as he revives and is then befriended by a local girl who hides him and tries to get him to a transit point where he can travel to safe harbor. What Strange Paradise asks hard questions about the ways those who are privileged find to discount others, to hide from our common humanity. Omar El-Akkad is a journalist and author of the best-selling novel American War. He was a war correspondent reporting from Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and many other locations around the world before he turned his hand to fiction. Omar El-Akkad, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've covered, as a reporter, you've covered the Arab Spring and the military trials in Guantanamo Bay. I recently read your previous novel, American War, which I think I can safely say is informed probably by your reporting. How did your experience as a journalist motivate you to write these novels?
I think when I first started as a journalist, which I should say is the only real grown-up job I've ever had. I was a reporter for 10 years at the Globe and Mail, a newspaper in Canada. And I started young. I started in my early 20s, and all I wanted to do was cover conflict. But again, I was also 21, 22. I'd read too much Hemingway, and I had this very sort of warped vision of what it is a war correspondent does. And then I actually went out and covered these stories, and it sort of shattered my impression of the mythology surrounding what is essentially a tourist in someone else's misery. You know, you parachute into a situation where people are experiencing immense suffering, and you try your best to be empathetic and to tell the world in the hopes that you could affect positive change. But at the end of the day, you get to leave. You have the central privilege of being temporary in this situation. And what that left me with was a lot of residual questions and emotional experiences that I didn't know how to get out in journalism. Storytelling fiction has always been my first home since I was a kid, since I first learned to write. And so I took a lot of these residual experiences and I tried to sit with them in the context of fiction. And that essentially ended up being American War. American War was a novel that was the geography of all the questions I couldn't answer from my time as a journalist. And I think it reads that way even to this day. It's not a prescriptive book. It doesn't leave you with a sense of if we do this, this, and this, everything will be okay. It's sort of the opposite of that. And one of the fascinating things for me about that book is that I finished writing the first draft about 3 weeks before Donald Trump announced he was running for president. And because the industry is what it is, it takes time for books to get published. The book ends up coming out in April of 2017. So, you know, 4 months into the Trump administration. And immediately I'm getting emails from people telling me that I was trying to cash in on the Trump administration, or, you know, as though I had sat down on November 10th and wrote the book, or, you know, something like that. In my mind, it has never been a book primarily about America. I was trying to take someone else's story. I was trying to take the stories of people on the other side of the planet whose suffering is largely discounted in this part of the world. And I was trying to overlay it onto an American context. The notion being that there is no such thing as a foreign kind of suffering, that everybody reacts to the same way to being on the receiving end of injustice. And overwhelmingly, that's not how that book has been read. It has been read as a commentary on the Trump era, a commentary on America's fracture. It has been read as a literal attempt at prophecy of how a second civil war would happen. I intended none of this. I just happened to release a book in a very incendiary moment. And so it's been read very differently than how I was thinking about it when I wrote it.
And the suffering of people on the other side of the world is really at the heart of this new novel, What Strange Paradise, Omar El Akkad. And this novel is, I assume, as everyone says, inspired by the case of Alan Kurdi, the young child found dead on a Turkish beach in the fall of 2015, when he and 11 other refugees from the Syrian civil war, they drowned in the Aegean Sea while trying to reach the Greek island of Kos. So talk about that as an inspiration for this novel, What Strange Paradise.
Yeah, I mean, the book had its genesis moment a few years before that incident. I started thinking about the things that eventually led to the book in 2012. I was still working as a reporter at the time, and I was back in Egypt, which is the country of my birth. I was back covering the aftermath of the Arab Spring. And I was driving around with an old high school buddy of mine who was complaining about the most universal thing in the world, rent. The rent's too high. And at one point I asked him, so what's the price for an apartment in your building, for example? And he said, well, do you mean the locals' price or do you mean the Syrians' price? I said, well, what do you mean the Syrians' price? What is that? And he said, well, we've had these influx of people coming in here. And you can charge them three times as much. I mean, they have no choice. What are they going to do, go somewhere else? And just the sort of casualness of that cruelty, which wasn't, you know, exclusive to apartments by any stretch of the imagination. You would go down and get fruits and vegetables from the stall down the street. They would hear your accent, put two and two together, and realize that they could gouge you. And so the casualness of that cruelty between neighbors, between countries that at one point used to be the same country, Egypt and Syria at a certain point were a single country. How easily you could take advantage of the most vulnerable. was the starting point of that novel. And I started writing it and sort of putting it together over the course of sort of 2015, the moment when the world really gave a damn about human beings crossing the Mediterranean. So I got to see the full spectrum of nobody caring for a very brief amount of time, the spotlight being on this and people caring, and then nobody caring again. And so the book for me was largely about this idea of having the privilege of instantaneous forgetting, which I think is another defining aspect of the Trump era, where you'd wake up every day and there would be a new scandal. And just as a form of psychic self-defense, you would have to forget about yesterday's scandal to make room for today's scandal. That kind of instantaneous moving on was something I really wanted to write against. And of course, it's hard to think of a more flagrant example of that than a child who dies trying to escape, trying to get to safety. The photograph comes out into the world. For a short period of time, we are all outraged, and then everybody moves on. When I talk about this, I tend to ask, when I go to bookstore events, I tend to ask the audience, how many of you remember that picture? And almost everybody's hand goes up. And then I say, how many of you remember this boy's name? And almost every hand goes down. And that's not a criticism of these people. I think it's just a function of the kind of society we've set up. And What Strange Paradise is very much written against that privilege of instantaneous forgetting.
And, you know, the experience that one has in this world at this time is that the crises are so relentless that people forget how much they may actually be connected. Is that something you also sense or feel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two novels are very different in many superficial ways. You know, American War is a bit of a kitchen sink of a book. It's sprawling. It covers many years. It has all these fake historical documents from the future and so on and so forth. And What Strange Paradise is much more surgical in intent. It's a much shorter book. It's a much quieter book. But thematically, I think they're closely related. I think generally, if you're engaged in the business of literature, you are engaged in an act of trying to expand the spectrum of who gets to be called human. Because I think we've set up the kind of societies that implicitly or explicitly rely on huge swaths of the population being subhuman, being considered subhuman and not worthy of basic dignity. And I think if you're writing, if you're engaged in literature, you are trying to obliterate that classification. And so I'm not sure if my books have ever done anything. I don't consider it to be an obligation of any writer to change anyone's mind. If you write fiction, that in of itself is enough. All I'm trying to do is for the duration of however long it takes for the reader to go through my book, is to get them to not look away. What they do after that is sort of beyond me. But that, I think, is touches on this idea that we live, you know, I say generally in the West, of course, there's many, many counterexamples, but we live in a society where we have the privilege of looking away without consequence. And for the duration of however long it takes to read one of my books, I hope for that privilege to go away.
Right. Or we think it's without consequence. I mean, in reality, the consequences are apparent all around us, but we maybe have not personally experienced them this way. And this book, What Strange Paradise, describes in excruciating detail what it's like to be dehumanized as a refugee, and in particular, what it's like to flee on one of these precarious boats that cross the Mediterranean, where so many people have drowned making that crossing. And, you know, it reminded me of the experience I had of seeing the movie Schindler's List, where the depictions of the Nazi Holocaust are horrific, but because of research that I was engaged in when I was writing a book, I was also very acutely aware that the reality was so much worse than what I saw on the screen. And your descriptions of the journey at sea are also horrific, but the reality must also be so much worse. And how did you struggle with bringing this harsh reality to life in the novel?
There were two areas that sort of gave me the most trouble. One is sort of overt, and the other was much more internal. The overt one that I didn't know how to handle had to do with the intersection of reality and fiction. You know, the novel in my mind is a reinterpreted fable. It's the story of Peter Pan reinterpreted as the story of a contemporary child refugee. And so it has many fabulistic elements. The flora and fauna on the island is made up. There's things that happen that have a real sort of fantasy quality to them. And yet when I was putting the story together, the parts of the book that seemed the least realistic were the ones where I had pulled verbatim from real life. So there's a scene in the book where Amir, the central character, and his family are watching TV in Egypt. And there's a press conference where this general from the Egyptian military is telling the world that the Egyptian military has created a device that cures all diseases. And the audience, made up of journalists, is applauding this man. And it's the most ridiculous thing. When you read that scene, it's just the most implausible series of events. All of that happened. That's a real thing that happened in Egypt. They had a press conference where a general declared that the military had cured all diseases. And so you go into it and you think that the purpose of fiction is to intrude on reality. And then you find that because of the situation you're writing about, reality is intruding on the fictional. And I had a real hard time with that. So that was the sort of overt part of it. The more internal part just has to do with this idea that I'm writing about real misery that real people have experienced. And I'm doing it in the form of fiction. And at the end, I have the right to walk away. And that leaves me with a very dirty feeling because it feels exploitative. And I want to write about these things because they infuriate me. And it infuriates me that we've created the kind of world where this suffering is not only acceptable, but in some cases encouraged. And I want to write about it. But I also know that I have the privilege of just leaving afterwards. And I struggled with that quite a bit. And I continue to struggle with it because these are the issues that I tend to write about. And I don't know if I have any right to be doing that.
Well, that is profoundly affecting there, because what you said earlier is that you turned to fiction to be able to express something that you felt as a reporter. You know, your privilege as a reporter to leave didn't allow you to bring to an audience, and yet you still feel this lack or this guilt almost.
Yeah, I mean, in journalism, at least you can put something on the other side of the scale, which is to say, at least by doing this, I'm putting the story in the public record. Maybe it shows up in DC or on Parliament Hill in Canada. Maybe an MP or a congressperson picks it up and they decide to do something about it. Maybe I can affect change that way. And that offsets the dirty feeling I have of parachuting into someone else's suffering and then taking off afterwards. In fiction, that calculus is much more abstract. I have to believe that by putting this novel out into the world, maybe somebody will pick it up and it will alter them in that very undefinable way that literature alters people. And maybe in the long run, years later, they will become changed in some way. And all the evidence is to the contrary. I mean, very few novels can be said to have had that effect. But you have to believe it if you're writing about these kinds of issues. And it's difficult for me to keep artificially balancing that scale so that I can keep writing these kinds of stories. Normally, when writers say this kind of thing, there's a but at the end of the sentence where they explain why they're going to keep doing it anyway. And I don't have that. It's very much an open question in my mind whether the act of doing this offsets the privilege of doing this.
I mean, it's a question about the impact of art. And I mean, and I can say as a reader of this book that it brought home to me the reality that you're trying to depict in a far more visceral way than almost. I mean, of course, there are journalistic accounts that do that as well. There's very powerful journalism. But when you're reading the headlines and a post in the newspaper, it doesn't have the same impact as a novel of this kind.
Oh, thank you. I mean, thank you very much for that. That's very generous. I should say that when I say that I had trouble doing this in journalism, it may very well be the case that I was just a bad journalist. You know, it may be that the form fully allows for this, and I just had to do it in fiction because I wasn't able to do it in journalism.
Well, you were an award-winning journalist. You know, it's interesting, though, that you talk about a fable, and you just mentioned that fantastical press conference I remember watching, I was glued to the screen when Tahrir Square was happening in Cairo. And I remember the moment when I think it's Sisi who got up and the people started shouting, "The people in the military are one." And I got an absolute chill down my spine because the military and the people are not one, and I knew they weren't one. What was your experience of that and kind of how people tell themselves the fables that they need?
That's a really interesting question because for a variety of reasons, one of which being that because of the kind of upbringing I had and the parts of the world in which I grew up, I am very, very cautious of anything involving the military. And of course, now I live in a country with an entirely different relationship with the military. I mean, in the United States, you have football games that start with these sort of, you know, the honoring of soldiers or these jet fighters flying over. And it's very much an established part of the culture. And it's very difficult for me to explain to someone who may have grown up in that context why that sort of thing always scares the hell out of me. And it's because in a place like Egypt, the military is as much inward looking as it is outward looking, which is a very scary thing. You know, in addition to having soldiers on the street and having, for example, a specialized police force that only takes care of tourists because foreign tourists bring in so much money to Egypt, you know, that force being pseudo-militaristic, every force in Egypt, police or otherwise, having a kind of pseudo-militaristic aspect to it, that bleeding through is incredibly dangerous for any society. The military runs factories. A lot of people a lot of civilians owe their employment to the military. They have that kind of loyalty to the institution. And at the same time, we live in a country where the military essentially runs the country. We pretend we have a civilian leadership, but of course we don't. What we have is a pseudo-military dictatorship. And I think when you hear that on the streets, the people in the military are one, what you're really hearing is a kind of wishful thinking, you know, based on the notion that if we say this enough, maybe it'll be true. And in reality, it's not true. In reality, the military runs the country. And I'm always, always terrified of this idea of glorifying the military because I grew up in that context. And so even though now I live in a place where that relationship is very, very different, I still carry that caution with me because I've seen what happens when you start pretending like it's okay for a military to be part of civil society in every conceivable way. It always, always leads to ruin.
And so interesting that, I mean, you saw the power of the people at Tahrir Square, and it's almost as if they gave it up in a moment. Now, I'm not sure whether, you know, it was a foregone conclusion in any case that if they hadn't given it up, the military would have come in and destroyed them. But I think, you know, in this book, in What Strange Paradise, there is a real struggle between ideals and a cold, I don't know if I want to say cold reality, because, but at least, you know, the two different views. There's one character, Muhammad, who says that conscience is the enemy of survival. I wonder if that's something that you believe or it is just expressing, you know, one point of view in this very troubled world.
Yeah, I should say that I very rarely agree with anything any of my characters have to say about the world. But, you know, especially with someone like Muhammad, who's you know, clearly a villain in the story, but is also a very pragmatic villain. He thinks in those terms. He doesn't have the privilege of being precious about any aspect of life. Yeah, I was thinking about the context of something like Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring revolutions in general. There's this thing in Egypt, there's a guy, a profession, it's sort of an unofficial profession, I should say. It's called Menedi. And a Menedi is a guy who sits on the side of the street. And when you go to park your car and you're parallel parking on the street, he'll sort of get up and guide you so that you don't bump into any of the cars, and it's understood that you give them a few bucks afterwards. And the hierarchy is such that this person will always call you sir or madam, and it's understood that in the class hierarchy, you are above this person. Class hierarchy is obviously present in every society, but it's especially present in a place like Egypt. And I remember talking with one of my friends in the aftermath of the Arab Spring in that sort of chaotic brief moment of actual democracy. And he was outraged because at one point he was parking his car and one of these people didn't call him sir. He thought, now that we live in a democracy, I don't have to do this anymore. And this infuriated my friend. And I think that this is one of the things that you don't really think about so much when you're in the middle of the brush fire part of the revolution, when you're tearing things down, you're getting rid of the old structure, is that there's a lot of people out there who will put up with anything. They'll put up with a dictatorship. They'll put up with outright fascism in exchange for order, in exchange for everything to be just the way that they've always known it to be. And I think that's one of the things that sort of sunk a lot of the revolutions that came about during the Arab Spring, is that there was this quiet middle of society that didn't care in the slightest about democracy or freedom. They just wanted things to be orderly. And this, I think, is a hallmark of the villains in What Strange Paradise. They understand the power of order and what kind of horrific injustice people will put up with in exchange for the semblance of order.
And Omar El-Akkad, you also turn your lens, I guess you could say, on the contradictions in the Western white world, including those who have compassion for refugees or care about the refugee crisis. One character, and I'm not sure if it's Muhammad or one of the other ones, I don't remember, says to the people on the boat, "You are the temporary object of their fraudulent outrage, their fraudulent grief. They will march the streets on your behalf. They'll write politicians on your behalf. They'll cry on your behalf. But you are to them, in the end, nothing but a hook on which to hang the best possible image of themselves." Clearly, this is a struggle. We've already talked about how we have so many crises coming at us that it's a whack-a-mole situation, And I guess I'd like to ask you to talk more about your view of those in the Western white world, one of whom is one of the heroes of this book, is the girl, Vena. Are you calling into question her goodness? Are you calling into question the compassion?
I think within the context of the novel, she's calling into question her goodness. So Vena is, it's never sort of explicitly stated, but she's white, she's half Greek, half Swedish. She is of this island. She was born and raised on the island where Amir, the boy, washes up. And she's 15. She is struggling with this growing realization that so much of her trajectory in life has been determined ahead of time, not by anything she's done or anything she hasn't done, but by accidents of birth, her choice of parents, her choice of region to be born into, none of these obviously being choices at all, the color of her skin, the language she speaks. And she's trying to figure out what it means to be a good person when so much of your success or your absence of suffering in life has been determined on your behalf by a lottery that you happen to have won. And so to me, she's a fascinating character because she is trying to be kind and she is trying to be empathetic and she's trying to do the right thing against all odds. But in the back of her head, there's always this thought of, does this make me a good person? And I think to me, that's been one of the hallmarks of looking at progressive movements in the United States and in the West in general, is that there's always this notion of, does the right thing make me the right kind of person? Is this the correct opinion to have? Is this the correct thing to say or not say? And all of that is important on a personal level. But again, it is a privilege to be able to think in those terms. At one point, one of the characters in the story asks another, "Have you ever tried to be kind to somebody who's better off than you?" Kindness demands asymmetry. You lend a hand down because you're already up. And she's trying to figure out how to be a decent person in that world. And there's no good answer for it. I think that is one of the issues that liberalism, progressivism, whatever you want to call it in this country, struggles with every day. This idea of trying to be a good person, getting in the way of doing the right thing sometimes.
There's another quote here from Colonel Kethros, who's another one of the villains, although, like all your villains, there's a nuance there. But he makes a statement that I found very bleak, you know, that in this world, people can't come together. The days of people coming together are ending. This is a time for coming apart. What do you make of that?
So I talked about the novel being a repurposed fable, you know, a reinterpretation of Peter Pan and Colonel Kethros, who's the central villain on the island chapters, the chapters that take place after the boy washes up on the island. He's sort of my Captain Hook of that section of the novel. And when I was thinking about him, I had an old physics teacher in high school who was obsessed with this idea of never memorizing formulas for, you know, trajectory or speed or whatever, that you should be able to derive formulas from basic principles. And I think of Colonel Kethros, who is someone who has memorized the formulas of manhood, you know, a firm handshake, stand up straight, look people in the eye, all that sort of chivalry type stuff, but has no idea how to derive these things from basic principles of kindness or decency. And so he's someone who has a very brittle view. You know, he comes across as this very sort of hyper-masculine kind of individual, but he's actually incredibly brittle in his positioning in the world because he has this surface layer understanding of what it means to be a good man. And any time that understanding is pierced by reality, all that's holding it up is violence. And so I was thinking a lot about that kind of man because I grew up around these kinds of men who had very firm views on what it means to be a strong man. And any time reality contradicted them, they had no real capacity to deal with that except to resort to violence. And so Kethros is that on the individual level. But I think the reason he is able to operate with as much impunity as he has is because we've also designed institutions and systems that have the same flaw. They depend on a surface level understanding of goodness or righteousness and have no connection to fundamental premises of decency or kindness. So I think there's two parts of him. There's the individual part, and then there's the systemic that allows him to get away with as much violence as he does.
It puts me in mind of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. It's a book I think of often. Frankl was a prisoner at Auschwitz, and he says that the search for meaning is rooted in one's capacity for compassion for others. I think, you know, that's a real thing. That is, in fact, what Viktor Frankl says is the core of being human. What's your sense of that?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the book that influenced me the most when I was writing What Strange Paradise is a book called The Wandering Jews, which was written by Joseph Roth. That's what it was. And it was written about 100 years ago. And it's a nonfiction account of Jews in Eastern Europe who were escaping to the West to escape horrific persecution. Some of them find their way to the West, where they find an entirely different flavor of persecution that in many cases is kind of camouflaged and dressed up in a civility and a kind of genteel veneer. And the book obviously is 100 years removed from the current crisis of refugees seeking asylum across the Mediterranean. But so many of the small details read like they were written last year. This notion of people having to resort to forging ID cards, for example, because they've been afforded no other choice by the system that seeks to categorize them as subhuman. All of these things sounded like nothing had changed over the course of 100 years. And this to me is one of the fundamental things that I try to get at in my writing, is how dependent our current setup of society is on a giant underclass of human beings who must necessarily always be subhuman. And once you start treating their stories as though they mattered exactly as much as the stories of people who exist outside of that class, you are naturally engaged in the process of taking the entire thing down. And in that regard, I am very much a class warrior. I'm very much engaged in the act of trying to take the whole thing down.
And I think that answers your own questioning of yourself and your privilege. I mean, after all, you can use your privilege, in fact, to help take that system down in that inside-outside game. I mean, there are others who are working very hard, who are in the position of those who are being persecuted, who are also struggling to take the system down. And that system, I think that's so important, because one of the really poignant people and characters in this book, in What Strange Paradise, is Madame L. Ward, who is, I mean, tell us who she is. She is a good person, and she runs the refugee camp that's there on the island. It's been set up. I don't know if you'd really call it a refugee camp. It's more like a penal camp. But she runs it according to the dehumanizing rules of the authorities, because she is facing, you know, that Hobson's choice. If she doesn't run it that way, it's closed down, and then they have no place to go.
Yeah, so Madame L. Ward, I think her first name is Nimra L. Ward. She's an interesting character to me because I don't have much in common with my characters, and I also don't steal whole people. I steal slivers of people from my life, you know, personality traits and that sort of thing. So she's not exclusively someone I know who's been transferred into fiction or anything like that. But I think we have a common trait, which is adapting to the several different kind of people we need to be at any given moment. I think any immigrants listening to this interview will know what I'm talking about. This idea that, for example, when I'm talking to someone in this part of the world, I am a very different person to them, depending on which aspect of my identity they've latched onto first. If the first thing they hear about me is my name, I'm going to get treated in a different way. If the first thing they hear about me is that I'm Muslim, I'm going to get treated a different way. If the first thing they hear about me is this accent that you're hearing right now, I'm going to get treated an entirely different way. So she is someone who came to this island from a different part of the world. And so she's aware of the obligation to respond to different reflections of yourself based on what people perceive you to be. When we first meet her in the story, she's trying to manage this refugee camp that's been built to fail, essentially, by the government. And she's talking to the provider of drinking water to the camp, who on that morning has delivered the water in the same truck that they deliver the oil in previously, and they haven't cleaned the truck between shippings. And again, it sounds like this cartoonishly evil thing to do. That is a real detail. That happened. And so she's got this tainted drinking water to deal with. And she's trying to treat the people in this camp like human beings while simultaneously trying to be multiple different human beings to get what she needs to get and to have these things done. So she strikes me as having that central trait that a lot of immigrants have, which is managing multiple versions of yourself at once to get through the day and to achieve anything at all.
Well, it is so powerful. I guess I have to ask you one last question, which is the book alternates between before, that is the journey to the island, and after, the fable of the two children, and the rescuing of Amir by Vanna. Yet that fable comes to a successful conclusion, and yet in the very last chapter, which is now, that conclusion is called into question. I'm not sure how much you want to reveal about this or not, but I wonder if you could talk about that last chapter and what you are trying to leave the reader with.
Yeah, because I'm a deeply insecure person, I tend to Google the title of my book a lot just to see what people are saying about it online. And you know how Google sort of auto-completes, like gives you suggestions of what you're searching for? And if you start searching for What Strange Paradise, one of the suggestions is What Strange Paradise Ending Explained. So clearly some people out there are having a real hard time with how this book ends. I will say a couple of things about it without sort of giving too much away. When I started writing the book, when I sat down and actually started writing the first draft, and this book went through 8 drafts, the only thing I had was the opening paragraph and the closing paragraph. And throughout the 8 drafts, those didn't change. Almost every other part of the novel changed, but the opening and closing paragraphs didn't. And also the book is a very, very different book depending on the reader's familiarity with the two works that are quoted on the epigraph page, which are Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie and An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce, which is a short story. Depending on how familiar you are with those two pieces of work, the novel reads very, very different. But all of that said, most of the angry emails I get from readers have to do with the ending. And there's been many, many different interpretations of what's happening in that closing chapter. I have my own, but just because I wrote the damn thing doesn't mean mine is right. I've heard some far more profound interpretations than anything I was thinking of.
Well, my listeners will have to read the book to come up with their own interpretation. The book is What Strange Paradise, Omar El-Akkad. This has just been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Omar El-Akkad. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from What Strange Paradise. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.